Hello, and a warm welcome to our Thursdays with David Foster Wallace series, where we every week read a section of the infamous Infinite Jest with the hope, of course, of finishing the book by the end of the year. Today's section is pages 601 to 638 in the 20th anniversary Back Bay Books edition of the text published by Little Brown and Company. A couple of announcements to start the show today. I have more, of course, announcements, but we'll save some of them for Sunday or slash Monday's episode, just for the sake of keeping things brief. So first announcement is I finally caught up on all of our Gmail emails. If you would like to email us on the show, I usually answer those personally myself as the host, so that is something to look forward to if you want to share something neat. I've gotten a lot about Infinite Jest recently, which I love. I just love hearing you guys' experiences, and your contributions to the show really matter a lot to us. So thank you for those of you who have emailed, and if you want to email, just do it. There's nothing really barring you from doing that. I would encourage it. Next, we've revamped our Patreon, and so that has always been linked in the description, but more and more, we have been considering adding ads on the channel, and for now, we have decided to just approach advertisements and funding the show from a Patreon perspective. And that means that if you find this show meaningful to you, and if you really gain a lot of value from this show every week, twice a week, then one way you can show that appreciation is through Patreon. We have two active subscriptions going. Both of them give you access to a private podcast, which meets once every month, as well as a Patreon-only book club that we are doing once every other month. So if you want say and stock in those two things, make sure to check out our Patreon in the description. We are also reworking our website, and this means sort of cleaning things up. It needs a little bit of a spring cleaning at this point. There's a lot of info on there. We're looking at a different way to do the calendar because I know that we haven't been the best on updating the calendar recently, especially since the show schedule changes quite a bit. In terms of content, in terms of things that we're expecting with interviews and things like this, and as well looking at reworking vocabulary and how we upload vocabulary for David Foster Wallace and our series. Also, one of our avid commenters brought this up to my attention, and I think it's important to address, so I'll address it here. Chapter headings in Infinite Jest, I tend to use them quite a bit in terms of anchoring points in our text. So, for example, last episode I made reference to a chapter heading on page 563, and that's our last big chapter heading also for this section. And I'm using that for an organizational tool for us since we are all reading the book together loosely, but it's also digital, and I feel like there isn't a lot of organization in this book as it is, and so especially if we're operating on different types of books with, you know, of course I have the 20th anniversary Back Bay Books edition, but you might have the 10th anniversary edition or another popular print edition of this book. So I wanted there to be something substantial and concrete that we could all make reference to when we're starting these different sections. And so I do want to clarify that this book is non-linear, it's very cinematic, as we've talked about, and the chapter headings do not belong to all of the section that we cover. So that section heading that I read at the beginning of the last episode, that does not pertain to the section that we went over last week, but rather I was using it as a device to be able to catch us all up and organize us all on the same page. And indeed, that is the last chapter section, again, for this week that we've seen. So we've just continued in this very long, crazy, almost digression, I feel like it is, without a substantial chapter heading for a long time. And if you want a way to relate this, I would look at films like The Limey or Magnolia or Pulp Fiction. These are all going to be very similar films that you can maybe relate the narrative to at this point. They're non-linear, they are wonderful and splendid, but also sometimes confusing. And so I think these organizational devices have worked well for us on the show thus far. Let me know in the comments if they haven't for you. But that's why I use them again. So, starting on page 601 here, much of this episode will be about quotations. There are a lot of gems in this little section, and this section is action-packed. It's much like the section we did a couple weeks ago with Lucianne and where the wheelchair assassins bombarded their little video cassette store because they were trying to find a copy of Infinite Jest. But yeah, there's lots of action. It's gruesome a little bit, but we'll do our best to hedge that just a little bit for our sensitive viewers here. Page 601, we have a quote. And this is talking about Ennett House. We're really jumping right into Ennett House here. And so we're starting in on 601 again. There's always ones that always like to cut it close and play with the idea of getting discharged for something picayune, so it won't be their fault. And so we're talking about residents who will get discharged for essentially being late and missing the curfew, as opposed to getting discharged for an offense like getting into drugs or doing something illicit or doing something that otherwise would be a really bad, I guess, social mark or a mark of shame for them. So oftentimes residents will get discharged for doing something very easy, very simple that they could have easily avoided. But it's almost a mask. And the reason why I pulled out this quote right at the beginning of the episode is because it ties us in so well to last week with this word picayune. I have now officially added that word to my vocabulary. That means petty. And so if you think about, the picayune politicians or something along these lines, that's how I learned the word. So I just found it a really interesting reversal of the use of this word that we saw from last time. Remember last time, picayune was the word that really governed how we saw Ennett House, and every time this word came up, it was with a different sort of chore or a different way that Ennett House was this petty thing that eventually became unpleasant. And so here we're really talking about the manifestation of this sort of pettiness, but in a different way. And I love how this quote turns that whole section we just went through on its head. So, getting along in the narrative here, it's really a cool tableau of Ennett House shutting down for the night. And so, essentially, it's Gately as the live-in staffer. He's trying to get everything done, he's trying to fill out all these forms, and we see people coming back pretty late, pretty close to curfew. Gately locks the doors, and then Green comes back. From this, of course, we know that Green is just back from watching Lens murder this dog and get chased by these Canadians in Hawaiian shirts. But Green comes back from this experience 6 minutes late, and he gets the dreaded full house restriction that is explained in more detail in footnote 247 for your reference. And yeah, Green is petrified and Gately notices, but he's too wrapped up in all of the nightly routine stuff to notice much more aside from pulling a urine on him. And so Green, of course, has to be subjected to a urine inspection, as is common for this kind of behavior. And so, full house restriction also is dreaded because you can't leave the house, you have a very limited movement, and it's really, again, to discourage people from essentially using the picayune excuse of being late for curfew as an excuse to get discharged from the whole facility. We get to know a little bit more about Green and Gately's relationship through this encounter because we learn that Gately has been sort of like a sponsor for Green, and Gately feels rather sympathetic for Green at this point as well. I want to bring up the topic of single versus double quotation marks in the book, and I think this is a good place to put it. So, one of our frequent commenters did bring up to me that, yes, the book theoretically is in double quotation marks. And I say theoretically because at the beginning of my book, I am not seeing double quotation marks, but within the book itself, there's only single quotation marks, which is, quite unexpected, and DFW was very particular about his formatting, as we can already tell this long through the novel. And so for me, I'm torn. I looked it up, I did some research about it, and so some people, especially people who speak British English and have the British conventions for writing, say, oh, there's really no difference, it's more of a So maybe a stylistic expression or just a preference, not really expressing much meaning. Other people, though, especially those in North America, say, oh no, it means that, there is a narrator telling this story all the way through. Maybe it's to emphasize the fallibility of the narrator in some ways, because here, it's not a perfect recounting. We can tell that almost immediately in the first thread in this book when the narrator uses colloquial phrases like or the narrator has some really interesting commentary throughout the book, and that's certainly it becomes more and more obvious as we keep reading. But yeah, I'm a little torn about this. I think this is something that people use as evidence saying, okay, Dr. Incandenza or some other likely connected figure is the narrator for this book. But I am leaving the jury out just to be neutral on this. I have my own opinions, but I'm keeping them hush hush until we finish the novel. But I did want to bring this to your attention because it is important, and I do think I'm erring on the side, perhaps, that because DFW was so particular about formatting, this single quotation thing in the book is an indication that there's some narrator, and he's wanting to really make clear that the narrator is fallible and the narrator is also a character in himself or herself. Getting back to the main story here, we have an interesting bit. I think maybe that comes at the cost of this Onan reorganization that Boston and that area has had. And so essentially, one side of the street in the metropolitan area of Boston is the right side of the street to park on, the legal side of the street to park on, but at midnight, the side of the street that's legal to park on changes. So everyone in the middle of the night, if they don't want to get their car ticketed or towed, they have to get up and get out of their houses and move their cars. So they basically have to do a U-turn in the middle of the street in the middle of the night and move their cars to the new legal side of the road to park on. So it's a really interesting situation and one that Gately and other staffers at Ennett House have always hated. And so, because it's so tedious, and so essentially, it's after curfew, right? So Gately has to be in the middle of checking people in for curfew, making sure people are either there or making decisions about do I dismiss this person for being 20 or 30 minutes late after curfew. And Gately is doing this, and he's also in the middle, at this point, at midnight essentially, of rounding up everyone who owns a car, because Ennett House does allow people who have registered vehicles to bring their cars with them. So he has to round up everyone, get their keys, get their jackets on, everything, and they have to be supervised, of course, because you don't want people running away, you don't want people doing things that are illicit or bad after curfew, and there's a liability issue with these vehicles moving around, and of course, people being out after curfew. So it's a big mess, and Gately is really, it seems like a stressful situation, and Gately is harnessing some managerial prowess that maybe is not natural to him. We see that he has some headache stuff, and just he's pretty stressed about it all. And so, what's interesting though is that in the middle of this pain in the butt in the middle of this section. We get some gaitly wisdom, maybe gaitly wisdom fueled by our narrator here is a better way to put it. But on page 604, we have another quote. Gately's snapped on the fact that people of a certain age and level of, like, life experience believe they're immortal. College students and alcoholics, addicts, are the worst. They deep down believe they're exempt from the laws of physics and statistics that ironly govern everybody else. I love this. This is such a golden nugget of wisdom. When I read it, I thought, wow, that's so true. And it's so true also that young people get so fired up about things and I think often maybe don't think about the ramifications of them all the time. And there's a place and a time for that, for sure. And I think that young people are valuable in that way, that you can see this blind passion. But it says a lot about Gately that he notices it, and also the narrator notices that Gately notices. And so I just thought that was such a really great piece of wisdom coming from Gately at such a weird time in the narrative. And again, like, this episode is super governed by quotes. I'm gonna bring out a lot of quotes today because there's an important quote coming up that is one of the quotes that really influenced me to read this novel. Another quote from footnote 249. I'm not gonna quote the actual footnote here, but really, we learn that Gately is the cleaner-upper, always has been. He cleaned up after his mom consistently, never missed an accident, essentially. And I think that this also gives us insight into his relative ease, not only at Ennett House and dealing with abuse and sort of bodily fluids of all kinds, but also at his disgusting janitorial job from a couple episodes ago, probably it was a while ago at this point, but where he has to clean up some pretty intense bodily fluids every morning. And so I think that, and then also it's a very interesting bit of foreshadowing for what is to come, which is an amazing kung fu-esque fight sequence. And I think that Gately's almost his feeling of obligation to handle the situation comes from this, it seems like, natural inclination to clean up after people, to save people in some respects. All right, and on page 605, I wanted to mention really quick, I think there's a typo on page 605, and typos are something I find horribly interesting. I mentioned to a couple commenters that I had gone through James Joyce's typos in his Dubliners. And what a wonderful collection, first of all, is Dubliners is. And yeah, really well known for its typos. James Joyce was one of those authors that constantly revisited his past works and constantly was revising things. And so I'm interested also about typos in this book. What have you all found? Have you all noticed this typo in page 605? It's about 3/4 of the way down the page, and it's Gately period 4, and it's in the middle of the sentence. There's no reason why there should be a period here. The period isn't treated like a conventional period. There's no space. For example, the 4 is not capitalized. So I think this is a prime example of a typo, but it's the first one that I've found, and maybe, I don't know, does that say something negative about my close reading here? But I do think that typos are really hard to find sometimes. But anyway, my question for you all, have you seen any other typos? Are there any other famous typos that you have witnessed in the book? I know of one other typo that a commenter mentioned a couple weeks ago, and I'm gonna link a picture to that typo in the description, and you guys can have some fun with it there. Now, on page 606, this is the quote that I think put the seed in my mind to say you should read Infinite Jest, and this quote is, quote, "Everything I've ever let go of has claw marks on it," unquote. I love this quote, honestly. You guys, if you are listeners of the podcast classic on Sundays, Mondays, you know that I'm a minimalist, and I have been for 4 years now, and I love it. I think anything that you can do to clear the way for thinking about and creating a meaningful life or a more meaningful life for yourself, that's going to be something that will serve you really well in the end. And so, yeah, this is a quote that the minimalists, Joshua Fields Milburn in particular, brought up a while ago in one of their podcast episodes. And I know that Joshua Fields Milburn is a really avid fan of Infinite Jest and books like Freedom by Jonathan Franzen. And I think I can see the sort of influence from Infinite Jest in his writing, and I really do admire him as a writer. So I would check out The Minimalists. I'll link them in the description if you guys want to check them out there. And yeah, again, this quote was just one of those things that I think started my, or really piqued my interest in the book, because it really did seem like the book had a connection to every field, every subject, every kind of mode of thought. And I thought, wow, maybe this is something that I could really connect to if I started reading it too. Getting back to the story at hand here, so Gately goes up to a guy named Glynn at Ennett House. He's sick. He's a recovering alcoholic, and this is a sickness that some alcoholics can get when they're in remission and they're detoxing still from the drug. So Gately has rounded everyone out, rounded everyone up, rather. They are in the front part of Ennett House getting ready to go outside, and Gately has to run up and ask Glynn, hey, can Green move your car? As we remember, Gately does not have a driver's license, so he does have to round up Green and endure that sort of awkward moment with Green after he's pulled the urine on him. And while he's up there trying to get Glynn to move and to be lucid and to give him the car keys, all hell breaks loose. And so Green comes up to Gately, and I think it's important to especially remember that Green is the one that comes and gets Gately. And Green comes and gets Gately, they rush down the stairs, and Gately shakes up the whole house on his way down. And when they get outside, they see two Canadians. We realize they're Canadians a little later, but they are Canadians. They're chasing Lenz around Lenz's car, and one Canadian has Lenz's mustache in hand. We remember that Lenz has to wear a disguise because he's a wanted man. And there's a third Canadian off to the side, and he has a specialized weapon and is threatening the other car movers who live in Ennett House with the weapon. And he's saying, you know, don't move or I will shoot. There's a quote on page 608 that I love. Quote, it's not so much that things slow as break into frames, unquote. And I think this is a cue almost for the cinematic beauty of this section to really shine through. I will say this is a hard section to read, and I'm not sure if it's just me. You guys can let me know in the comments how you went about reading this, but I had to read it closely and many times to understand it. And I think it's just because there's so much that happens in every phrase. Not even in every sentence, of course, is just quadrupled because DFW is so good at getting information into every word. And so here is the high action sequence. I'm just going to essentially do a tally for you guys. So starting on page 611, we know that these are the Canadians at the Hawaiian-themed party who essentially realize that Lenz has killed their dog. And so on page 611, it's made clear by the phrase luau-ish shirt. Say that 10 times fast. And it's really interesting, actually, the ways in which you're subtly clued in. And I love how measured DFW is with his language in this section, because there's so much foreshadowing, but it doesn't feel like foreshadowing until afterwards, or unless you are just really, really close reading in the novel. And so we know that these are the Canadians, and it's important that Green got Gately because Green knows who they are and he knows why they are chasing Lens. And so it's just, I think, expanding that connection and reminding us of Green's connection with that event. And the tally of the fight that ensues between Gately, Green, Ken Ardedi has a role in it, Yolanda has a role in it. There's many people, but the principal characters here are Green, Gately, and the three Canadians. So at the end of the fight here, Gately has a broken toe, a slashed calf that was slashed with a knife, and his shoulder gets shot as well. So he's not doing too great. He's bleeding out a lot at the end of the fight. Green has a broken nose that is not looking good, and there's a lot of blood everywhere. The Canadian number one here, the first assailant, Green, or sorry, Gately rather, breaks his hand. And the hand gets broken when the first punch is thrown, actually. So that was really Canadian number one's fault. And then Gately dislocates his arm and assails his nether regions in a way that I am going to refrain from describing. Canadian number two has a busted chin, thanks to Gately, and maybe he is deceased because Gately has smashed this guy's head into the windshield of Lenz's car in order to inoculate him. Canadian number three was half Nelsoned by Green and kicked with many a high heel by a couple ladies that were present, and also tackled by Lens, Green, some other people. And we're not sure about the state of Canadian number three either, whether they are dead or alive or not. So it's interesting to me because each resident responds so uniquely to the situation. This is a spectacle, for sure. Absolutely. It was a spectacle for me as a reader. And we get into spectacles later, so I want you to keep this in the back of your mind for the episode currently. But this is something where each resident has a curated, unique response. So Ken Ardedi just keeps his hands up and waits, and he has his keys in his hands. And the whole thing, even when it's clear that the Canadians have been inoculated, he just keeps his hands up. But interestingly and importantly, he observes Joelle's behavior towards Gately. And so Joelle's behavior, as Ken notes, has a little bit of a disposition towards romance, and Ken is sort of going, oh no, about it. And I think a lot of, when I read it, I said that too, oh no. And Joelle, during this scene, by the way, she's in the upstairs room and she climbs down. And so she climbs down by way of the side of the building as well as a tree. And so she's the rescuer, essentially, of Gately in this scene, for sure. That's illustrated especially on page 618. I have another quote. I think this one is maybe one of my favorite ones in the episode. Quote, "Get him off the phone. Say prank for Christ's sake. You hear me? Her kimono smells good. Her voice has a staff-like authority. The scene out here has changed. Gately's down. Madame Psychosis is in charge." I love that quote, don't you? So here we are, and there's a distinct tone shift that's happening within this quote, which is why I love it so much, is because it's so useful. It's like the quote itself is a device. It's written beautifully within single quotation marks here. And I love that colon. The scene out here has changed, colon. Gately's down, Madame Psychosis is in charge. And so here it also cues another one of those foreshadowing moments that also shows DFW's great restraint as a writer. And so here we eventually realize that Gately, when he's in this crazy blood loss, trying to stay awake state, he realizes that Joelle Van Dyne is Madame Psychosis. And this is the first time, I believe, in the novel where we've really clearly and consciously made that connection of Joelle with Madame Psychosis. And so I'm not saying that it wasn't obvious that Joelle was Madame psychosis in earlier parts of the novel. That's been obvious for a long time. Joelle as Madame Psychosis. They have been linked, those two identities, before, but I think that having an external character realize that and having that click just go into place was really important for our sense of the narrative here. And I just really felt that it was a powerful moment within this narrative. It's like there's this big wash of confusion for a page and a half, and then all of a sudden, Madame Psychosis is in charge and the narrative totally changes. And that's where we leave Gately and the Ennett House residents. Gately's being moved inside. He's losing a lot of blood. He's about to become unconscious. He's throwing up places. And two of the Canadians may be dead. We're not sure. The third one is definitely inoculated for now. And there's a security guard slash cop that Kenardetti has been sent to placate for the time being, and it's a big mess. There are cars everywhere. There's, of course, bodies, blood, broken glass everywhere. Lens is still feeling the effects of his earlier decisions with drugs, and Gately did not get a chance to pull a urine on him, so that is where we leave off. Page 620, there's another quote here that I wanted to bring up. Quote, and get this, 94% of all Onanite paid entertainment now absorbed at home. Pulses, storage cartridges, digital displays, domestic decor, an entertainment market of sofas and eyes. I also love this quote. I think it's so clever. An entertainment market of sofas and eyes. I don't know what weird image I get in my mind of like a sofa with some eyes on it, but that's pretty much what I see when I really hear that quote. And of course, the quote is meant to be taken metaphorically if you are like me and really see the sofas with eyes. But here we have a point in the novel. It's very technical, actually, and it's a big shift in terms of voice and style from our sort of traumatizing place we left off with Gately and Ennett House. But technology, I think, in our world is already approaching this sort of extreme. And especially with services like Netflix and Amazon, that's certainly something that we can relate to, is this mass consumption of entertainment and this willingness to spend your time and your resources in order to acquire this sort of entertainment. And I think that also, that connection between our modern world and even the world that DFW was writing from when he wrote this in the 90s, that gives us an extreme insight into Infinite Jest. And so Infinite Jest is the ultimate entertainment. Why wouldn't people want to spend time, money, resources otherwise pursuing it? And so this gets back to the crowds thing that I was talking about, how Gately's showdown with the three Canadians was a crowd kind of seeking event, and an interesting outcropping or side effect of this increased digitization of the world, where a lot of workplaces, schools, etc., are digitized and done from the comfort of one's home. An outcropping in this iteration of the universe is that crowds and crowd seeking becomes ever more popular. They call them spect ops, and one such spect op we'll get to in a minute, but I really think this is this relates to a short story that I read in the book Me Talk Pretty One Day by David Sedaris. That's one of my all-time favorite books. I read it every single year, have for 3 or 4 years now. And there's a Sedaris story, short story in that book about roller coasters and how he witnessed once a woman hanging upside down on a broken roller coaster ride, and he was fantasizing about her death and different things that could have happened to her. And there was a huge crowd, of course, thinking the same thing when they were spectating this event. And so I think that's just a connection that I made this time around when I was reading. And I will put the name of that Sidaris short story in the description box in case you would like to read it. So, getting back to the main story, we have Rodney Tyne, who we've encountered before, especially in Mario's Interdependence Day puppet film. There's a stenographer, Steeply, and Tyne's son, Tyne Jr., in the room, and they're overlooking a spectop of a duck pond that gets cleaned every year in November. And so it's a really dismal day in terms of weather, in terms of the chill, but there's always a huge crowd that starts to gather and observe how these people are cleaning the duck pond, the hordes really and surges of ducks that either decide to migrate because of the cleaning or stay there and stay put despite it. So it's a really interesting example, and I'm also interested, I think, it's sort of mentioned in passing, not really, there's a couple paragraphs devoted to it, but I'm wondering, what's up with Steeply and his mention here? I am so anticipating and so looking forward to hearing more about Steeply and his relationship with these people in this room and what they're doing there. The last thread in this thread, so I guess the last little perspective that we get in this thread is the story of the engineer for WYYY. We know that he's a nerdy sort of college kind of type. He has a lot of acne, and he was the person who monitored Madame Psychosis's earrings, essentially, made sure the levels were good, and just sat there to ponder. We had a couple of outings with him on the roof a while ago in the book. And so this engineer is recouping the losses of Madame Psychosis. Essentially, what the station has done is they've just left her hour silent on air, and they ask people to either just think about her or to send good thoughts to her, essentially for a swift recovery. The engineer is currently sunbathing at the park, the same park of the duck pond, and he's sunbathing on an incline and a hill, and this is important. So he knows only general details about Madame Psychosis's disappearance, or so-called disappearance. He knows that there's a halfway house involved, that there was an ambulance and a short rehab visit involved, but he really doesn't know anything besides these vague sort of pinpoints of information. And he, as we later learn in the novel, will come to regret this. He is kidnapped by what seems to be rogue wheelchair assassins. And so this rogue wheelchair assassin essentially parks, there's a van parked at the top of the hill and a van parked at the bottom of the hill, and the wheelchair assassin launches himself down the hill and scoops up the engineer as he's sunbathing in this cold November day, and launches himself back into the van at the bottom of the hill, and that's that. And that's where we leave for this section. Page 627, we have a new chapter heading finally, 11th of November, YDAU. I have a quote on page 627 that I think sets the scene perfectly. Quote, Stice, oblivious, bites into his sandwich like it's the wrist of an assailant, unquote. And so we are, of course, in the ETA mess hall, or one of them, and these kids are just eating. They are just eating, and I think their disassociation from eating almost, and eating in this really animal way, is stemming from the fact that they must consume calories. It is like an animal urge at that point because their bodies are so wasted by this extreme physical exercise that they are doing every day. And so, yeah, eating is described throughout this section in many different ways. Maybe some people would find it uncomfortable or something, but I found it just interesting and an interesting look into how DFW views this kind of exercise and fueling your body. And so It's such a cool scene. I really like this scene, actually. And so Hal and Stice had played a game earlier in the day, and Hal beat Stice only 7-5. And so we'll learn about more about this later, but it's a huge deal because since Hal's vast improvement on the courts, no one has even been able to come close to touch him. And Stice is the top boy in the 16s, and Hal is, of course, a little older. Hal is number two, still to John Wayne, and John Wayne hasn't been touchable either, so it's a big deal that the 7-5 score stood. As an aside here, Trevor Axford says, or thinks that food tastes the way vomit smells, and this is because of a head injury, or another kind of injury that he had when he was younger. Axford and Hal have an interesting relationship in this thread as well. We're gonna focus in on on O. Stice, rather, Ortho Stice, for a moment here. So we get some insight into his family, into his ways, and we know that his nickname is the Darkness, so if that comes up, you'll know who it is. O. Stice has six siblings, and his parents have a very spicy relationship. There's a lot of tension in this relationship, and I'm gonna leave it at that. There's tension that creates consistent highs or consistent lows. And so that's the relationship he deals with, and he realizes increasingly as he gets older and is living at ETA that it's not necessarily normal. And so he uses it mostly to leverage some funny stories that he can bring home with him to ETA. So Axford and Hal, they are connected because, along with Pemulus, except Pemulus has detached himself from this label and this group containing Hal and Axford, actually. Axford and Hal, they're still suffering from this weird meeting that we had with CT and the urologist. So we're not sure. This whole thing is shrouded in mystery. Like, what did the urologist do or say? What did CT do or say as punishment for Astrotan? We have no idea. And we know that Hal has willed himself into being chemical and secret free for his urine check upcoming in 29 days. And so, whatever that means, I haven't really connected the dots here very well yet, as you can probably tell. But yeah, I'm still thinking about this, you know, what this means, what kind of ramifications this might have, and also what connection this has to Hal's state at the beginning of the novel, his total loss of control, loss of communicativeness. And I think we're getting close to the point where he's going to, those two selves of his are going to merge. So I'm trying to figure out the exact connections here. If you guys have any insights for me that don't involve spoilers, please. I would love to know. So we hear in this section as well that Stice really should have beat Hal. It's just Stice's own mental limitations that have allowed him to fail here. And so Hal has had a weird sort of collapsed moment, and he's about to just completely disintegrate on the court, seems like. And Stice is also having this weird, like, telepathic sort of luck on the court. So there's some thoughts about that as well. Something important is that things have been disappearing and reappearing all over campus. So we saw this a while ago, actually, where the USS Militia Kent and Mario had a meeting, and there was some weird object in the middle of the forest that they encountered. And there's another example here, which is that a lawnmower appeared in the middle of the kitchen one morning. So it's been happening all over campus, and it's getting worse, not better. And I'm going to speed up through the last few points to save my voice here for Sunday's episode. But we have Trolch and his obsession with whether or not the milk is powdered. The answer is yes, the milk has been powdered for 4 years. Hal and Mario know this. There's also a little quip about Freer at the very end of this section, and Freer is pretty good looking, and he's juxtaposed with Stice here. And so Freer is good looking, his dad invented this thing called the phoneless cord, which I love. I would love this. If someone would get me this for Christmas, I would laugh so hard. But it's called the phoneless cord, and it's just this gag gif, sort of like a pet rock kind of thing. And we get this image of Stice, and his body is fantastic. So, you know, he's an athlete, he's a star athlete, so his body's really toned and it works really well for him, but his face looks like a bulldog, and it's sort of like a mismatch situation going on where he has these sort of jowls that make sounds and that are just, again, incongruous with his physique. We also learn that Ingersoll and Pen are recovering from the Game of Estrodon, and they've lost between 6 and 12 months of development in their professional tennis careers. Of course, Hal, Axford, Pemulis, they're going to pay big time for this. And we learn that Oren was in love with Joelle van Dyne after she was disfigured. But I'm wondering, like, when was that point where she was disfigured? This is page 634 for your reference. My question for you was, wasn't she always the pea goat? And maybe her labels just changed where she just decided to wear the veil? Because I believe, if I'm not mistaking, when we first came across Joelle van Dyne, when before Oren was on the football court, before he tried out for it, or rather the team, before he tried out for the football team, she was not wearing the veil and whole getup. So yeah, I'm just wondering what changed and what was the point at which she was disfigured, or was she always disfigured? Thank you guys so much for listening to this very long episode today of Thursdays with ZFW. I wish you a wonderful couple days until our next episode, and as always, leave a comment or an email if you have any questions.